Hello, everybody. It is great to be here one more time today. My name is Gary Fowler, and I am the host of SimpleNet AI Presents. I'm a serial entrepreneur with 17 companies under the belt. I was under the original management team, Click Software, which was sold to Salesforce for $1.35 billion, and also Eva.ai, an AI HR tech company that we formed in 2016. That company was actually one of the early generative AI companies, pre-transformer models. We believe at GST that intellectual capacity is evenly spread around the world, but opportunities are not. And with that, I'd like to introduce an incredible guest, Jacques Fu, who's a good friend of mine. He's a co-founder and founding CTO of Stax. He was part of an incredible journey. Has been the FinTech Orlando. It was the first company in Orlando and one of the seven Florida unicorns. He built an integrated payment system that processes over 23 billion in payments annually for over 22,000 businesses. So with that, I'd like to bring Jacques on board and we can talk a little bit about his journey. Hey, Jacques.
Hey, Gary.
So now tell me a little bit about, are you originally from Orlando?
No, I was born in Paris, moved around a little bit in my youth, but we did settle in Florida, and I consider myself a native. Been here since I was a young kid, but yeah, Orlando is my home. Wait a minute,
you were born in Paris, so that's yes. Obviously how you got Jacques is your first name. How was that? How long were you there?
I wasn't there long, not long enough to pick up the language. So I did, acclimate to the States pretty quickly.
So you moved down to Florida and then, so you went to university, I understand, in Florida, in Orlando. But, as you went down through, what made you decide to get into technology and how did you get started with Stax?
I got a computer later than a lot of my peers. But in college, I took computer science, but I found it, I had a knack for development. I did a lot of coding on my own, and I actually ended up switching majors and eventually dropping out because I was already kind of getting into startups, building companies, and I guess I didn't really see the point at the time of graduating. That's how I came into become really a software engineer first and then a founder. Had a couple different startups, met my partners at Stax in an accelerator here in Orlando called Starter Studio. We hit it off and joined forces to create Stax.
So when you went down through the journey, you started out with one and the company grew and you became a unicorn. What was it like going through those changes? So from it's almost like a club, right? When you get started, but then it becomes serious. How does a company evolve? How did it feel as it was going down through those evolutions? So one, it's going through your seed funding, Series A, Series B. I guess you did up to Series D, when I understand. But going down through those levels, how was it different? How do people adapt to the culture when you're changing like that and growing?
Well, at the end of that, we sold that company a little over a year ago, right? So we exited to private equity. We went through the whole thing. And I'll say, in the beginning, it's a lot of fun, right? Like if you have a good, good co-founders, then, and I did, you really feel like you just, you fit into each other like a puzzle piece. And you're also friends, right? And you're just spending a lot of time together. You don't really think much. I mean, yeah, there's a lot going on, but all of you are rowing, the same direction, it's exciting. It's electric. As the company grows, you have to have a lot of structure, right? So you really actually have to think about, HR functions and scaling the business and forecasting and having budgets and teams and liabilities, and then it becomes okay. This is like a job. I worked myself into a job, and then I'll say personally, maybe it becomes a little less fun the larger you get. All in all, I wouldn't have changed anything. It was an incredible experience, and it's just something magical to see going from zero to one to exit, right? That's I feel blessed to have had the opportunity to do that. I think statistically, it's like somewhere like 1.5 million or 1 in 1 million companies ever make it to, you know, a billion in value. So I definitely I do think that I have some skills that played a part in it, but there's definitely a in that as well.
So when you went down through it and you went down through and got that exit, how different was your life from the time, you know, imagine a couple of years ago and then to the exit? How much does your life change?
You know, I try not to, I kind of have a philosophy of not having what do they call it? Lifestyle creep. Right. And so, you know, like my personal life didn't change too much. I try to keep myself pretty grounded. Right. Sure that we went on an extra vacation. We bought a couple extra things, but after that, I think it was, you know, back to work, and, you know, we still, had to continue on a little bit with the business, right? Like, generally it depends. Some PE firms just kind of want you to go right away, and others want you to stick around. But we all kind of eventually, you know, found, things to work on. I ended up starting, Pete, which is a workforce, training AI, company. And so, you know, I would say that, you know, entrepreneurs are kind of a different breed. Like, I certainly could have considered retiring young, but I just can't help myself, I guess.
No, I understand that for sure. Been down that road a couple of times. And you go down through it and you look at it. So how differently did you look at starting the next company, Pete, as Stacks, right? How different is it? Because now you've got some security behind you, right? But how much different was the process of going through that journey, starting Stacks and then starting Pete?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are obviously always going to be differences with every startup, but I think I try to stay in the B2B lane so I could take advantage of the knowledge and the experience that I had in scaling the previous business, right? So the structure, the go-to-market motions, that things would be familiar. And then, of course, I could reuse, hey, this thing worked last time. I'm going to try that first before I do an experiment. But I still think, you know, the market's constantly changing. You should always experiment. You know, the reason I started Pete stands for personalized education, training, and enrichment. And if anyone's curious, they can go to Pete.com for more information. But, you know, when we built that, when we grew Stacks, we had no idea it was going to be a unicorn. We're like, oh, we'll make a $10 million company. Like, that was kind of, you know what I mean? I don't know if my co-founders have necessarily said that, but we definitely didn't think from day one that it was going to be a unicorn. And, you know, we grew in a few years. I'd seen the team. We had like 40. In just a few years, it was like 400. And I'm thinking to myself, like, how are we going to train all these people? How do they understand our company? What mistakes are they going to make as they're learning, right? And so, you know, Pete was kind of a way to say, hey, how could we use AI to make it easy to roll out training, right? Like, if you've never done it before, how do you get that instructional design expertise? How do you use AI to lower the cost, to personalize that learning, because everybody is going to be in a different part of their learning journey, right? They may have some industry knowledge. They may not. They may know more about, you know, your company. They may be in a different role. So you can't just give the same sort of generic training to everyone. You can't just buy a course online and expect it to apply it to your business. So you really need AI to customize every element of that learning experience. But, you know, at a few hundred employees, you may not have the scale to hire a whole department of trainers and instructional designers and learning professionals. So how do you get started? And this was, Pete was the solution for that.
Now, that sounds great. And, you know, you and I partnered on a company called Simple Night. So tell us a little bit about, when we first got started on that journey together, we came up, I remember when I first talked to you about it. And, you know, I had some ideas and you had some ideas and we went into this thing. I don't think anybody had, I had not heard in the Valley or any of the friends that I know had done anything close to what we were trying to do at the time. But let's talk a little bit about that journey. And, you know, if you look at Simple Night, let's talk about what is it really and what kind of impact is it going to have?
Yeah, I mean, I did not always travel a lot until I had kids and I wanted to give them, you know, more experiences. And so, of course, this is the worst time to like learn how to travel, right? When you have all these extra added logistics. Planning a trip is painful. It's even worse when you have to bounce around through all of these different, you know, sites. And if you want to really personalize it, right, you can't just buy sort of this canned thing online. And so we ended up, you know, I finally said, okay, I'm done with this. I'll pay a little extra. I'll go through a travel agent who can really get to know me and my family and create something that's hyper-personalized for what I want, right? That's, you know, that's somewhat expensive. It costs more. You kind of have to rely on some bias there. That you got to pick a good agent that's going to take the time to get to know you and is also not, you know, potentially doing things that are self-serving when they recommend things to you, where they may be getting a big kickback or something, right? And so, you know, it also somewhat time consuming, right? Like an agent's still human.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you there's just so much data out there, that infobesity problem. It's hard to figure out what's there, you know, and then how do you get your seat in the front in Delta on the right-hand side in first class? And then who can be in San Francisco that you could meet with? I mean, the parameters, there's so many things all the time.
There's so many elements to it, right? And then you get a site that's like, oh, you go to, you know, anyway, so we went through all these series of problems, and but Simple Night, what's incredible about that solution is, you know, they have built the network of relationships. They have an infrastructure to handle millions of fluctuating inventories within that network, and they basically created a new experience for travel that, you know, mimics that AI, but that travel agent, but it through agentic AI, through, you know, advanced technologies, and just streamlining it in a way that it kind of has the best of both worlds, right? It's like a human travel agent in the ability to be able to handle, you know, ad hoc queries and challenging requests, but it's still an AI, so it has direct access to query millions of inventory at speed without having to, you know, read through it slowly like a human, and you know, has, we'll call it, less biases. There's always a little bias, right, when you're training, when you're using language models as part of your stack, but less biases.
You know, and you're right. You know, it's interesting. Do you remember when we started using the term hyper-personalization like 2 years ago? Made it up, right? And people started to talk about it, but that's what it's all about. You're right. It's about these hyper-personalized experiences. And if you take that relationship, kind of like your grandmother that loves you and cares about you with empathy and compassion, that's really the next level of this thing, right? And that's one of the things, you know, take it from a pragmatic approach to one of a care and compassionate approach. And as we look down through it, you know, look at this journey, these kind of tools, Jacques, are things that, you know, being able to buy anything, anywhere, at any time, being able to book anything, anywhere, at any time, is going to be critical. We need these engines to be able to help us deal with that infobesity problem around us for everything, right? Imagine what you can power with it. So if you look at it, you know, if you look at Simple Night, what do you think in terms of technical challenges? What kind of technical challenges? Well, I know in the beginning when we started down through this journey, right, it was new territory. We weren't sure what was going to work and what wasn't going to work, right?
Yeah.
And we went down through that journey. But, you know, when we went through this, and I know some of the answers to the question, we went down through it. you know, we would go back and forth on it. But how was that, you know, when you're in new territory like that and coming up with something that's extraordinary, how was that? How do you keep guiding the ship technically through that direction when you have so many different options, shall we say?
Yeah, I think you have to be suspicious about all of your previous best practices and think about if they still apply, right? And so, you know, one of the, I'll give you a key example is, you know, large language models have a non-deterministic nature. They have some parameters called, you may have heard of it or referred to as temperature. And the reason that language models seem so human is that they don't necessarily always respond the same way to the same set of inputs, right? Which is awesome if you are engaging with an LLM and you don't want that robotic feeling and you want the creativity of the model to be able to apply to problem solving. It's terrible if you're trying to verify that it's going to always work in a certain situation. And so previous automated testing tools will go and click through a user interface as an example, right? And we'll say, okay, well, you click this button, you put this, this is what the output should be. And so the automated test will say, hey, yep, that test still passed, or thumbs down, you know, you committed some new code and that test no longer passed. And that's how a lot of, regression testing is done, or QA is done with applications these days. However, when an AI can behave differently to the same query, right? In one case, it can answer the question. In another case, it could ask for additional information. So now you're static. Well, I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to say this. Well, it can't be the same every single time. So what we learned was you now need AI to test the AI, because you need something that can react to what's happening that isn't static, right? Like, so that was one of many learnings.
Yeah, that's a great let's talk about that again. So you need AI to be able to test it, because it's going to be different. It's a novel approach every time, just like a human, and many humans may answer a question in an entirely different way. That's interesting. So how do you put a moat around it, though, so it doesn't go out and say, let's go to Africa, but let's go to Antarctica first? You know what I mean?
So that's a great point. So let's say, okay, so we have one of the things we learned early, right, is you have to make these flows agentic, and you have to give the agents tools. You still have to give them a goal or an objective, but you also want to give them some guidelines. So it's kind of a balance of where do you put all of this logic, right? Do you put more in the instructions? Do you put more in training the model? Do you put more in the tools? So if you only give the agent tools, right, and you give it a rigid set of instructions, then when you ask it to do something new, it'll respond that it can't do that, right? It hasn't seen that training data before, right? Like it won't know what to do, and the tools that you've given it are only work a certain way, right? If they're very prescriptive. An example could be, I want to, you know, go to theme parks that are pet friendly. And, well, you know, theme parks don't have a pet friendly filter checkbox or something, right? Mm-hmm. In the database. If you make things too rigid, the AI would just say, oh, well, that's, I can't filter by that. But if you instead give it tools, you give it some freedom, you find what are your highest risk areas, right? What are the areas where, hey, I really can't have it. if I have the, you know, for example, if I have the AI pick the wrong city because I only gave you a city name. I said Paris. Mm-hmm. And I assumed you knew I live in Texas. So
well, that sounds familiar.
You would know I live in, I want to go to Paris, Texas, not France.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a terrible, that's a very high consequence. So
right.
There are certain things where you have to, you know, ensure that the AI has a, you know, that it is a very conservative approach. And there are other cases where you can let it be creative. So,
no, that's fantastic. So, you know, going down through it. So for, if you have advice for three pieces of advice for aspiring tech entrepreneurs looking to build platforms, because you've done a lot, what would be those three things that you would say to them?
I don't think that my advice would be novel, other than that it would be to actually follow them. Because I feel like there are a lot of places where you can get a lot of the same advice, but it feels like people don't seem to follow them. I'd say one is you really got to talk to prospects and users early, very, very early. I know a lot of people will work on an MVP for months, and they said, yes, I'm going to talk to them very early. I'll get this MVP. And then they'll just work for months. And I'm like, no, you should, if you want to do something, like, you should go talk to someone today. Like, you know, people, like, you could literally pick up the phone and talk to them today. You could go online and engage with people on social media about whatever it is.
Yeah,
and
that's a good
see
point.
How they react. Like, why would you wait until your MVP is built to go talk to someone?
Well, but, you know, and it's like building a house and finding out the foundation's cockeyed instead of fixing it, you know, before you start putting the framing up. You're right. Customer development. In fact, there was a book by Steve Blank and Bob Dorf. Bob's a good friend and was a good friend of mine. And unfortunately, he's not around now. But the Startup Owner's Manual was about going out. You're right. You got to get out of the door and ask questions. Because you start building stuff, people may not want it. And you may have to tweak it, right? You got to continuously pivot to get it to the point where somebody's going to buy something. Because that's what it all matters, right? Are they going to buy, Bob used to say, are they going to grab it out of your hands? And you're right. And so that's door number one. So door number two is, how do you go down through, Jacques, and keep a positive? You're always positive. I've never seen a person actually as positive as you. How do you go down through when there's all these pitfalls? How do you stay positive going down through the journey? You come up with a roadblock or a technical challenge. How do you stay positive?
You know, it's not, I don't think it's about staying positive. I think it's about staying grounded, right? Like focusing on what you can do, what's within your control. I won't label myself, but I have, three folks that I listen to. Their names are Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, forgot the third one. My point is, I am a follower of some philosophies that really focus on the sphere of control that you have. And I think, you know, it's not about toxic positivity. I mean, if you've heard that term before, it's like, everything's great. It's going to be awesome. Like if you're not optimistic about this, then, you know, we don't want you on the team. It's not about that. Mm-hmm. But it's at the end of the day, it's everything's solvable. And if it's not, you know, you'll likely survive it and move on to the next challenge. So why are we going to, you know, sit around and worry about how complex everything is and what's going to break next and all the problems that we're going to have? When we could take the same energy and, you know, focus on solving them. So,
well, you know, you're right. You know, going down through multiple pivots with Eva and also with Click Software, you know, we started with a little Israeli company and, you know, did an IPO on NASDAQ, and we had a lot of challenges. And one of the things I'll never forget, my dad told me, he said, you know, never work on emotions, right? You're right. Staying grounded is really important because you got to think through the decisions. You know, making emotional decisions is not a good thing, right? But you got to stay grounded. And if you do that, it's going to surely make life a lot better. So I agree with you. And so the third thing, as you're going down through that and you look at it if you could say, you know, the difference between the 9 out of 10 that are unsuccessful and the 10% that are successful, what's the difference between those two? What's the one point, as you see, is the difference between those two groups, the successful entrepreneurs and the unsuccessful? Is there anything else out there?
Yeah, I think the unsuccessful entrepreneurs tend to take too much risk, right? And I don't mean, I take a lot of risk, but risk is also measured by, it's like, what is the probability of failure? And what is the magnitude of the success or failure, right? And so I would call it, they take too much downside risk, right? So I take a lot of risk, things that could fail, but they're things that maybe I only invest a couple days in. They're things that I can recover from. They're things that, you know, would only affect me financially, you know, a couple percent, right? It's okay. You know what? Let's try ads in Reddit. You know, we've never advertised there before, but let's try it. But let's not put $10,000 in there. Let's just put like $1,000 and see how that goes, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'm wrong, then I've only lost $1,000. It's not a big deal, right? But if I'm right, I've discovered a whole new channel and I can pour money into there and grow my business so much faster. And so that's what I mean. It's like, you want to take those risks that have a high upside and a very low downside or zero downside, right? That's one that I almost say is almost zero downside. There are others, such as we spoke about, some of those entrepreneurs who will spend months or years building the thing before they even show it to anyone, to know that they're solving the problem they think they're solving, that anyone's going to want to buy it. That's a huge downside risk. The downside risk is you just wasted a year of your life thinking that you're building something useful, and it could be extremely useful, but it may only be useful to you.
I agree with that. You know, so extremely useful for yourself. The other thing is they try to build perfection. They never get it out because they're trying to make it perfect, and it doesn't ever happen. There's no such thing as an absolute, right? So you're trying to do it and pour money into it, and you never get it out to see, to write again, to test it, to see if people want to buy it. You're trying to make it perfect.
That would be the other thing I would say. So successful entrepreneurs, right? It's like they optimize for upside, minimize downside, and I think that you know, some of the, there are exceptions, right? And it could be that some of the survival bias that we see in some of these really successful, you know, the Elon Musks of the world, the Jeff Bezos of the world, they get a high inflated ego. It could be that when they were earlier in their journey, they were much more modest and grounded, right? But I would say that, you know, entrepreneurs that are, you know, closer in touch with reality, and also don't necessarily, aren't afraid of their ego getting hurt. Like, I'm not afraid to ask a dumb question. I'm not afraid to ask for the sale and get a no, to ask for investment and get a no, right? Because I don't really.
Because if you don't ask, you don't know.
If you don't ask, you don't get it. Like, that's, you know, not getting the opportunity, right, is a bigger problem for me than someone thinking that I asked a dumb question. And most people aren't really thinking that. They're just, you know, they're thinking about themselves most of the time.
It's fantastic. Listen, we're coming to the end of the show. Closing thoughts, and how do people get a hold of you, Jacques?
I mean, they can you know, reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn, so feel free to connect with me there. And as far as, you know, if you want to learn more about, you know, training your workforce, you can go to Pete.com. Look forward to hearing from you guys.
All right. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule. Thanks for taking time on a Saturday morning, to join us today. And thanks to all of you for joining one more time. Simple Nights Presents. My name is Gary Fowler. I'm your host. Stay happy, stay safe, and stay healthy. And I'll be back to you again soon with another exciting edition. Thanks everybody. Gary. Take care.